Sir John Tusa anchored top UK current affairs show Newsnight in the 1980s, before heading the BBC World Service for 7 years. Though today a member of the British establishment, he was actually born in Czechoslovakia and moved to England as a small child. That was when his father, Jan Tusa, was appointed head of UK operations of the Batya Shoe Company. Sir John was a special guest of the Jihlava Documentary Film Festival, and I first asked him there about his parents, who had been born in the days of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
They always said they were very lucky to have the 20 years from 1918 to 1939, which they were very proud, of course, of being citizens of Czechoslovakia, and they thought it was a marvellous state as well. So that was something that they looked back on with pride and also with regret, that the things that happened to Czechoslovakia did happen.
And when exactly and how did they leave Czechoslovakia? And
they left in the first 6 months of 1939 because my father, who worked for the Batya Shoe Company in Zlin, was appointed to run the Batya Shoe Company in England. This was very fortunate when you think about it. And my father went over and he started work, and then he had to make a lot of fuss to get visas for the rest of the family. And we only came over, I think, in June of 1939. And so that was it. People always assume that we were political. Luckily, we weren't, but we were certainly very fortunate to leave when we did.
And in the management of Batya or Bata in the UK, was your dad unusual in being Czech, or were there many Czech managers there?
There were a lot of Czech managers. I always thought it was rather funny that the Czechs, the Batya company, in effect, behaved or acted like colonists. They came over to teach the English how to make shoes through mass production. And so there was a core of maybe 30 or 40 senior managers who came over from Zlin, and they arrived in southeast Essex, where there was very little work, not very much skilled work either, in order, as I say, to teach the English how to make shoes in this new revolutionary manner.
And what do you recall of the estate at East Tilbury in Essex?
The peculiar thing was that, of course, it's an exact model of the architecture and the buildings in Zlin. And I always thought it was very peculiar that we left Czechoslovakia from this modernist, extraordinary place, Zlin, and we arrived in England. And did we live in somewhere that was English, a quaint village or anything like that? No, we still lived in a Czech, modernist, Central European estate. I think it took me quite a long time to get over that, and I probably only saw the joke very much later.
How did your folks deal with the adjustment to life in the UK?
I think they were probably helped by the fact that they had so many colleagues and friends who were Czech, and so they could speak Czech to them. And their best friends were almost always Czech for a long time. I think in another way, it may not have helped very much, because it meant that they couldn't come to terms and get used, so to say, to living with the English. Also, I must say that people in the area, that is southeast Essex, always thought that my parents' language and the way they spoke, because of course they spoke Czech-accented English to their dying day, was really rather strange. I think that the English themselves didn't accommodate to these strange people from Czechoslovakia as well as they might have done. There was never any discrimination or anything like that. But there was always a certain distance that these Czechs were a bit different, which perhaps we were.
Did your parents ever see Czechoslovakia again?
Yes, my father many years later. My mother came back with us in 1961, us, the grown-up children, because I wanted to introduce my wife, we just got married, to my relatives and to Czechoslovakia. 1961 was very difficult, by the way. It was the depths of communist rule. The atmosphere was horrible. There was a lot of police supervision. Even when we were in my mother's hometown, Bystrice pod Hostinem in southern Moravia, the police would occasionally visit in the evening to make sure that they were there. We had to report to the police station and so on. It was not a nice atmosphere. And there were loudspeakers throughout the village which would give these instructions as to what people had to do. I don't think you could get away from the loudspeakers, probably even in the fields. It really was unpleasant. And of course, the worst thing was that our relatives said, "When will NATO come and free us from these people, communism?" And I remember saying, "Luba, I think you must understand that isn't going to happen. It can't happen." And I think he was heartbroken by that. So it was wonderful that we went back, but it was very, very painful, more painful for my relatives than, of course, for us, because we could leave.
As a journalist, you were involved in the early days of Newsnight. That must have been very exciting and also, I guess, a high-pressure job. You were the main presenter in the 1980s, the early 1980s. What do you recall of that time?
The wonderful thing about that programme was that it was a new programme and it dealt with news and current affairs in a different way. It integrated them into one. So it broke all sorts of rules inside the BBC. And therefore all the people who worked on it and the people who were editing it weren't interested in the old ways of dividing up the news from current affairs. And we all felt that if we had a good idea, we could put it on the screen, we could do an item about it in that evening. And that was absolutely invigorating. So it meant that everybody who worked on the programme knew they had the opportunity to be original, maybe to break the rules from time to time, and that was what was wanted. And it was an exhilarating 6 years. It really was. And we believed in humour, in irreverence, in originality, and that was a terrific atmosphere to work in.
In the mid-1980s, you became the managing director of the BBC World Service. How do you look back on that period?
It was very demanding. It was very hard work, but everybody at Bush House, which was where the BBC World Services worked from, were completely united by belief in what we were doing, and that was to give the best possible open, free, accurate information to all our listeners, the sense of dedication to the listener, wherever they were. And that feeling of we are doing the best for them, not we are broadcasting something that we're interested in, we were, but it was the listener who came first. And that was why we would fight for our independence, which was never in question, but from time to time we'd have to say to say the Foreign Office or to other parts of the BBC, "This is us, this is why we do as we do, and we will continue to do it." And we fought very hard to maintain that independence because we knew that that was what mattered. Listeners, after all, aren't stupid, and particularly listeners who live in a closed, authoritarian society. Hearing news which was accurate and which was giving them a different view of the world that was presented by their own official media, this was a high responsibility, but it was also a privilege to be able to broadcast to them in that way.
I was reading that when you were managing director of the BBC World Service that you had to, or that you chose to cultivate then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Why did you need to do that, and how did you find her?
Well, we needed to do it. I thought it would be quite sensible, given that in the end our funding came from the government, and that she was not a friend of the BBC, by no means. Therefore, I thought it was even more important that she should know exactly what the World Service was doing, why the government funded it, and the sort of things that we did. And she was actually quite open to this, I think, because the very first invitation we gave her was to say, "Come and do a programme where you answer questions from listeners in the Soviet Union." And I think this really attracted her. This tickled her sense of risk, perhaps. So she came to do that. That worked well. And then about a year later, I thought, it's time to have her again. And this time, we'll make sure that we will tell her. We have time to tell her what the World Service is about. And she was a very strange... No, she wasn't a strange woman. In some respects, she was very direct. And if she decided that she liked something and admired something, that was that. She would have made up her mind and she would stick to it. So I never had any difficulties with her. And she said she never complained about World Service coverage. Not at all. Quite the reverse.
You also headed the Barbican Arts Centre for many years. How did you find the difference between the two roles, being a manager or managing director, and journalism? Surely they require rather different skill sets.
I think actually they were very nearly exactly the same, and I'll tell you why. Because journalists and people who work in the arts are very similar. They all work because they believe in the values of the activity they're engaged in, whether it is providing the news or it is creating the best possible art. So they are all driven by this ideal and these values. They're also, nobody is in journalism or the arts to make money, because there isn't money there. So there is really belief. That alone made it very, very simple. You know, both organisations were united by this absolutely core belief in the importance of the activity we were engaged in. The best possible art mattered. The most true, accurate journalism mattered. And the people who produced those things, they were actually first cousins. So knowing how to work with them and to create an environment where they could do their best work, this was comparatively simple.
You left this country at the age of 2 or 3. How does it feel being back here today?
It's always very nice. It's always very nice. I've never pretend that I am more Czech than I am. That would be foolish. But there are all sorts of aspects, I think, probably to the way, maybe even that I behave, and aspects of things that I learned from my parents, that I learned from my father, again, which I probably can't even accurately identify, but which make me, and sometimes I'm told this by English people, which make me distinctly different and probably a bit foreign. I mean, at one level, of course, I'm British and British and British, and people say member of the British establishment and so on and so forth, but a rather different one. And that is very precious to me, and probably even more precious, because after all, the Czech Republic is one of my ways back into and to remain in Europe. And being European, I'm European because I am Czech, and also because I'm British. But Czech is, as it were, the doorway into being really European.
And you were telling me you're getting Czech citizenship.
I know I'll have my Czech passport, which I will use very proudly in a matter of a few weeks. No more than that. Long before Brexit, if it ever happens. But even so, I'd want to have a Czech passport, and I'm very, very pleased that I shall have one.